Welcome to Love Hate Automate, the podcast where digital dreams dress tomorrow's reality. I'm your host, Dale Parr, and with my weekly guests, we'll be diving into the vibrant world of digital fashion. Each episode, we stitch together innovation, creativity, and a splash of the unexpected. Hello, welcome to Love Hate Automate, where today we're zooming into the future of culture with the guidance of visionary Nayara Moya Erickson. Now, Nayara, formerly a fashion designer herself and researcher at Luxottica, has most recently been supporting brands and organizations who are looking to have a positive impact in our industry. Now, welcome to the show, Nayara.
Thank you so much, Dale. Happy to be here with you today.
It's great to have you here. Whereabouts in the world are you recording from today?
We are in Stockholm, and it's finally sunny, which is a miracle.
I was going to say, yeah, this is a good time of year for Stockholm, isn't it? The weather starts to finally change. But I detect a different accent, maybe not Swedish.
No, definitely not. I'm from São Paulo, Brazil.
Excellent. A long way from home.
Yeah. Life, future research takes you far sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's it. Why don't you introduce yourself to our guests? Tell us about you.
Definitely. I've been working in research since 2014. Basically, it's 10 years, 15 in the fashion industry. But I felt that it was a way that I could express myself and try to help other brands and people who had been through the same problems I had when I started my own underwear brand in São Paulo, fresh out of fashion school. That was my main focus and working in research. I moved to Sweden in 2022, worked for a year in the music tech industry. After we were laid off, me and at the same time 600 colleagues, I was I won't find a job that will suit me since it's very small country and area. Fashion here in Sweden is also a very closed market. I rather launch my own business as I had in Brazil for 8 years and decided to do the things that I was doing in São Paulo my whole life, basically. So that's how Scanning Sites came around. I think my main focus in my job is to help other people, other brands, and also a big focus in regenerative practices and methodologies and sustainability, because this is also extremely important for me. Coming from Brazil, where the Amazon is, it's very hard not to focus on this.
Fantastic. So obviously Scandinavia, incredible part of the world. I'm a big fan. I was recently in Denmark, very, very culturally aware, environmentally aware. Maybe you can give us a few insights of what you're detecting, you know, in Stockholm and in your local communities around kind of the digitization and transformation of fashion. What are kind of important pillars locally that you detect?
I think in this sense, like you said, they are very aware. Scandinavians are always thinking about ahead. It's a country that is so much focused in innovation, but it's innovation in a state way, which is very hard for entrepreneurs to start innovating. It's super easy to create a company, but it's super hard for them to deal with taxes, deal with all the bureaucracies around, because everything is very much regulated here. Which I think is good, but also very hard, makes it hard for us. Fashion-wise, I think we're talking a lot about the digital passport that we're planning to be launched EU-wise. I think the regulation has been approved already, so brands have to start adapting themselves to the launch of that officially. And also, I've seen many brands and companies, tech, focusing on sourcing great materials for fashion and making sure that the production line is sustainable, blockchain, these things that we, for us, is nothing new because we've been seeing and listening about these things for a long time already, but I can see that it's actually happening now. So that makes me feel quite happy and proud of seeing this transformation here so fast, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true actually, because I think it was probably 2021, 2022, where, I think
the people with that kind of foresight were saying, look, why can't products be on chain? You know, why can't experiences be on chain? Why can't kind of the value chain and the provenance of a product be on chain? And you're right, you know, 3 years later, we're kind of starting to see that come to life. And with the EU textile policy, that's obviously driving compliance, because perhaps ethics aren't a priority in some businesses, in some large businesses, but certainly compliance has to be, right? So no, it is great to see it kind of start to take shape in the way it is. Really? Now, what would be good is if we get into the body of the show, where we talk about kind of the love, the hate, and the automate. So you're incredibly well connected, talking to lots of participants in culture across fashion, music. What is it that you're really vibing off at the moment in terms of the transformation and the digitization of those industries?
Well, that's a funny question. Music has definitely been important for me because I always danced ballet my entire life. I was a go-go dancer in São Paulo for 3 years because also the fashion scene there.
Yeah.
And I love jazz, I love ballet, I love music. And I think back then it was very hard also to find brands that were supporting dancers. And when Adidas launched the partnership with Stella McCartney, it was when I was like, okay, now I have to keep my eyes on Adidas. I always had my eyes on the Adidas because football, I love football too.
Yeah.
So when those things started happening back in those days, it was like, well, someone decided to connect the two things that I love the most. So I think nowadays, yes, I think I'm very happy to see that Adidas is hopping on the Web3 trend or reality for us now. And seeing that collaboration with Genesis sneakers NFTs a couple weeks ago made me very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, recently launched the Metatabi collaboration with Margiela and the fabricant.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and back in November, I was very excited with the Gucci Cosmos cabinet. I thought that was a fantastic idea for fans of the brand. And also, if you just want to go around and check all the things they were proposing and like merging legacy, like my family is Italian as well. And so this iconic Italian brand doing this together, because we know Italians tend to be conservative with heritage sometimes. Yeah. So that was super cool. And the last project that I thought was super interesting was when Prada joined forces with NASA to create that next-gen lunar space suits. That was awesome.
Now, that is something that's amazing, isn't it? You know, I think space, that discovery of new frontiers, like we're seeing it in technology in a kind of a small way, you know, in how we live our lives. But yeah, to design a spacesuit, that is the next, the biggest frontier. Cool. I mean, the biggest frontier.
If we think about fashion-wise, in the 60s, when Courrèges was like drawing those like futuristic looks, and now seeing they like, oh, there are fashion designers actually designing the suits, you know, that made my heart shake a little bit.
Yeah. I think at London Fashion Week, I noticed there was a lot of very 60s-inspired looks and collections. You know, the ankle boots and the shapes of the dresses. And you just get the sense that there is this there's a synergy between the eras of optimism. We're in one of those at the moment, very, very similar to the 60s. And I suppose space travel is part of that, isn't it?
It makes me feel when I was a kid and watching, you know, the Jetsons, and you're like actually thinking that all those things could be possible.
Well, that's it. It's interesting because we thought that it was possible in the 60s and it hasn't necessarily manifested like that. And we think it's possible again, but will it take another 60 years?
I hope not. But also something that I don't think we were accounting still in the 60s was the sustainability factor. We started talking about in the 70s when we had the oil crisis, but now it's a must. So I think what should drive innovation is like the need of focusing on regenerating our planet and making sure that we stop or diminish at least the global warming that is like going nuts in the last few years.
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. You know, I've been kind of running some data projections, simulations on carbon footprint reduction across the luxury sector, which I'm going to be dropping on LinkedIn in the next few weeks. And there's some brands doing some great work out there, but there's some very underwhelming performances as well. So there's still a long, long way to go. And I guess that would be certainly for many, and particularly yourself being from South America, the protection of the natural world. That must be a frustration when brands say they have this intention, but they don't necessarily, you know, see that through.
I think they don't. They like to talk the talk, but they don't like to walk the walk. I mean, it's going to impact their costs. It's going to impact their revenues, and they don't want to do that because, you know, brands have to make business. It's their main goal. So
it's true, but could sustainability be a profit engine?
I think so. I am very positive about that. And I think that also consumers are, especially Gen Z, more focused on getting aligned with brands that resonate with them and all their values more than ever, you know.
Yeah, I think that often there's a resistance to it because brands don't really know what to do. They don't really know how to solve the problems, and they don't have a great deal of time in terms of a resource to really figure it out. And I think that it can be reframed. Capitalism can look at sustainability as in a positive light, you know, innovation in a positive light. You know, being innovative improves productivity. It makes you, it helps you operate in a better way, a more efficient way, a more cost-effective way than your rivals. Innovation helps you become a market leader. You know, it shouldn't be a deterrent based on cost. It's an accelerator, you know, and that's how sustainability falls within that innovation category, because we have to find solutions to problems. But once you find those solutions, they accelerate your business, you know. And I think that often leaders, decision makers are scared, or they're inert from it because they don't quite know what to do. They're out of their comfort zone. They know how to exploit factory workers over in Asia. That's something they just know how to do. Being a touch controversial, that is something that is just second nature, right? The bigger problem is the sustainability piece, the innovation piece, but actually that will accelerate a business more quickly than squeezing a factory for margin. And it's a mindset shift. It's a problem with people. The barrier is people. And we need to get over that. But anyway, this isn't about my frustrations.
But they are very similar to mine. So I think we're definitely in the same path when we talk about these things. Because after, you know, when you study fashion or when you work in the business, you see that the waste is something that is a misdesigned product. You're losing a lot every time you waste something. Wasting money, wasting time, wasting working hours. And it's a design failure. So why aren't we looking at that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not good for the environment. It's not good for the customer. It's not good for the business. And we still continue using these practices. I mean, it's a bit of stupidity there.
Oh, totally. Totally. If you've got, I talk about this thing called a legacy equation, right? If a brand wants to have an enduring legacy, it needs to do certain things well. One of them is the idea of innovation, because it helps with productivity. Innovation also helps with getting closer to your market, and it can help with, if you're close to your market, it means that you're more connected, more culturally resonant, which will help with your sell-through rates. And so you're already receiving a financial boost. You're selling more at a higher margin. That leads to less waste. because you're close to market, less product is being wasted. And then you can be smart, you know, you can look at kind of resource utilization to make sure that, you know, you use every single ounce of your, you know, inventory in the best way possible. And that takes a bit of innovation as well, it takes a bit of planning. But all of those things lead to a strong financial outcome. But at the moment, brands ignore all of those pillars. They just make what people don't want. They make loads of it. So it doesn't matter how much sell-through they have. They'll still make something at the end. And they don't care if they have to burn $20 million worth of inventory at the end. It's crazy.
It is insane. I mean, it's so ridiculous in the sense. But also what worries me is seeing business models like Shein, Zara, and H&M growing, and like fast shipping, shopping online, everything delivered to your door the day after. I mean, This is not fashion. This is just consumerism. This is insane. And as much as go ahead.
No, carry on.
No, as much as I like, you know, the facilities of the modern world, you know, I wouldn't like to press a button and get a couture dress in my door the next day. The experience wouldn't feel proper.
No, this is true. Yeah, this is true. You know, you do want that luxury experience. You want to have the time to get excited, the time to enjoy that moment, rather than just have something turn up. You know, it doesn't hold any emotional value, and it means that you're not going to look after it or care for it in the same way.
Exactly.
But interesting enough, I was looking at, I was doing some analysis on brands and their obsolete inventory. And brands like LVMH, obviously, it's a house of many brands, but they, on their balance sheet, they're quite happy to have 4% of their global value assigned to obsolete and impaired inventory.
Wow.
4% of junk, basically, in their eyes. They can't sell it. They can't do anything with it. So what will they do? It's got a lot of IP attached to it. They'll probably discard it or incinerate in some way. 4% of the value of the business.
That's a lot of
$3.2 billion, yeah. And this happens every single year. And they're not the only ones. You know, Kering have got something similar.
Yeah, I know.
Richemont, they all carry an awful lot of impaired stock. And the reason is that they don't know what the customer wants and they can't deliver it on time. These are fundamental business failings as far as I see. But there seems to be a culture where they're quite happy to post those losses on their balance sheet. But it seems crazy to me.
I just think it's extremely greedy. In a sense that, oh, let me burn my money here because I'd rather do that than, you know, share or, you know, help other people distribute, you know.
It's almost like an arrogance thing as well, isn't it? It's like, we're luxury. We set the trends. You either like them or you don't like them. If you don't like them, we don't care. You know, We can afford to waste all of this stock, all this material. You know, rather than just being like a servant to their customer base, giving them exactly what they want, helping them love, fill their worlds with joy because they're delivering exactly what they want when they want it. That's what brands should be doing. But, you know, I think there's a big cultural shift happening and I think it will take time.
Definitely. But I think what makes me happy culturally, shifting wise, it was the latest show from Maison Margiela and John Galliano, because that was just a joy to watch just pure delight.
No, I agree. Yeah, I'd loved the not only the fashion but the whole experience, you know, how the models carried themselves, how they were walking, the makeup. Everything about it was just a theater, wasn't it?
It was amazing. It was like, you know, we're around the same age. I grew up watching those shows on TV. That's what inspired me to be a fashion designer since I was like 4 years old. So seeing this coming back is amazing.
So I think just think about the show there. So we've been through love. We've been through some frustrations. I think I kind of went over the top a little bit there. Have you got anything else you want to add in the hate category before we move on to automate?
I think the part hate, and then maybe I want to just exchange some ideas with you in this sense. It's like, working in foresight and research, how do you feel? Because I've been facing now, since I moved here and I started doing more of this work in Sweden, a lot of problems with people just appropriating my work. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And I would like to hear also your opinion about that and how do you deal with that? Because for me, it's been a bit hard to deal with it.
Hmm. I don't know. I try and position my own thoughts and ideas kind of quite a long way ahead of today. Mm-hmm. So some of the concepts that I try and like develop are probably a little bit crazy to others. Probably 5-10 years ahead of the current time, imagining a better future for humanity and for the industry particularly. I don't know. I don't mind if people parrot thoughts and ideas, because I think that can be useful, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, echoing your own sentiments. I haven't really had or noticed anybody kind of like plagiarizing anything that I've done. I haven't really had that challenge to overcome. But certainly I don't mind if people do echo sentiment. Maybe you can tell us what's actually happened.
It's just doing exactly what you mentioned, plagiarizing and then posting as if it was theirs. And
if it was theirs, yeah.
It's fine. Yeah. I mean, it's going to happen anyways, but the feelings are not good.
No, not when you put, you know, something you've been working towards and then someone tries to, you know, basically lift your idea entirely. Yeah, that isn't fair. And that should be called out, I think. You have to tell me in the green room what happened, and then we'll go on.
I can later, but yeah. I can later. Not on the recording.
No. So let's just start to finish the show with the final section, which is about automation. Now, this section is really about, again, using our foresighting skills, our insights from the industry, maybe some trend analysis to really kind of think about, you know, what is next. And that could be an emerging tech. It can be an important tool. It could be something cultural. What do you have in mind for automate?
So when I read the question, I was thinking about, well, what are the problems that I would like to solve for us researchers? And I think it was like data visualization tools for fashion designers and design researchers. Mm-hmm. E-commerce sizing solutions. We have a few that are pretty good already, but we're still not there. I think we're very far from achieving the ideal future in the sense. I've been working with Fido Analytics in Berlin, and I know that they're doing an amazing job. Happy to be a partner when I was working with Sebastian Schuss, my ex-boss and the founder of the company, seeing how much effort and passion people are putting into solving this problem. But I don't know, maybe in your research you can, because you're more monitoring this kind of data, share with us in the future. How long do you might think that this is going to take? Because for me, it's still hard to visualize how long it's going to take for us to have, for retailers specifically, measurement tools that can help you.
Yeah, for the fit analytics.
Exactly.
I think what we see, the VTOs, I think, are quite, they've improved, but I still think they're missing a three-dimensional metric that every human body shape has, and it's very, very difficult to apply that in a 2D a 2D situation on screen, you know, on your mobile phone particularly. There still needs, I think,
in this sense. For me, it's not only the 3D body scan. It's also figuring out that different textiles have different textures and elasticity, mm-hmm. the fibers, mm-hmm. everything. Yeah. So I think it's quite hard in this sense.
Yeah. And it's understanding the fit of the intention of the design team, how they want it to fit. And then it's comparing that to what the customer prefers. And so, you know, when I was at the gaming studio, we had a huge task refitting a single digital garment to a number of different avatar body shapes. It's half a day's work for every single body shape. So if you have, and that's per garment. So if you're layering something, a t-shirt with a shirt, with a pair of trousers, a different, that's three items, that's potentially day and a half, 2 days for a single body shape. And you're morphing that and using blend shapes to do multiple body shapes. And then if you're doing it to custom body shapes, it's a real challenge. So at the moment, what we, I'm not behind the scenes in any companies at the moment, but what I'm guessing is we're getting an approximation of what an item will look on a certain body shape. I still don't think that's accurate enough. Oh. I still don't think it will diminish the return rates in a significant way, because people are still going to have that moment when they try it on at home, whether they like it or not. And they'll forget the VTO. That's irrelevant. It's like whether they like it or not, whether it fits them in the way they want it to fit. And I think that simulating that is still a very, very difficult thing to do.
Precisely. I agree 100% with you. But it's so cool, though, that we're striving so hard to get this done. You know, it's not going to be maybe in the near future, but hopefully soon.
What else? Do you think it is the silver bullet to solve e-commerce's returns rates?
I think in a way, yes, because for me at least, I'm 150. I'm very short. But every time I shop something online, I know my size. I know the brands I buy. I know the things that I mm-hmm. want to do. I never get the right size. And I feel frustrated to having to send back, because I know there is impact in environment. Mm-hmm. And also, like, it's going to take much longer to get to me. And sometimes they won't have the piece that I want, and then I'm going to have to get my money back. And it's super frustrating, just talking as a consumer now.
Yeah, it is. It totally is. Yeah, like my wife is just literally downstairs returning something to Ganni because of an issue with the fit. Yeah, and she's been waiting for this particular piece of knitwear for a while, and she was really excited, and now she's really disappointed.
Also, like, for us, at least for me, I said that nothing suits me here. I'm super short, living in Scandinavia. I basically have to costumize everything.
Mm-hmm. So. There you have it. Well, you know, there's a lot to be said about the waste problem within the industry, right? And what can be done with small scale, you know, ateliers or garment designers, because I've been, last year, I've spent most of my time shopping in vintage. Quite lucky where I am. I have like four or five really good vintage stores, pick up lots of pieces. I'm quite happy with that, you know, because it gives me, I know these items are, no one else is going to really have them. It helps me with my own kind of identity, save a lot of money, I save a lot of shipping costs. And obviously not everybody's in the position to be able to do that, depending on where you're geographically located. But I did notice I was in Denmark last week, in a city called Aarhus in the north, and so many vintage stores there.
Yeah, that's fantastic here. And also, I like to buy vintage too, but still have this sizing issue. But last year I got a few pieces that I'm like super proud, and I know that I'm gonna keep them for a long time, you know. That those are those things when you find, like, your eyes sparkle from the other side of the room and you're like, I need that.
I love it. So So in terms of automation, we still think there's work to be done with the body fit VTO.
Definitely.
Is there anything else? Obviously, there's a lot of businesses trying to kind of get into that space, and they're all going to have, it's going to be really competitive, isn't it?
I think so. We have also a company here called Volumenta working on the shoe fit. I've met them, in 2020. It's super cool. The solutions are also, but there's more for retailers, not so much focus on the customer. So like the customers can put the tool in their website and customer use it, try the size, the fit, especially for sneakers. Sounds very cool what they're doing. I'm more curious to see what is coming from them too. I also, like I said before, as for researchers and data visualization tools, but also tools for research itself. You're running qualitative research, sometimes you do have great tools already in the market, but I still feel like when you completed an interview or usability test, you want to have everything already organized and maybe press a button, print everything. If you have to like do screenings and talk to people, have a database of everybody, it's still not organized in a single place. And I think it makes me feel when I start a project of research, qualitative research, it feels that I have to plug all my toolboxes in one place and still struggle a little bit to get out of the insights out of all the interviews because of the mess that kind of it is still. When I was writing and thinking about it, makes me feel when I was like 19, walking around Sao Paulo with gigantic backpacks and like all the tools, going to uni and took me like 4 hours back and forth. You know, we have a lot of technology available for these things. It's 2024 and, well, researchers, UX researchers, tech researchers, fashion researchers, you still don't have all the tools that you need. What is wrong? Why not? You know?
Yeah. It's something I hadn't even really thought about. So what is your toolbox for when you start a research project?
I usually use a software like Google. I plug in some transcriber, record videos, but still sometimes have to go back, listen to everything, pass through the transcription because it's good, but it's not perfect yet. Rewrite, you know, analyze, and then edit videos together and, you know, put graphs together. Because the graphs are manually, you have to put percentages. You have to create the whole Excel spreadsheet of it so you can get a graph out of it. You know, I have many good tools, like I said, in this sense, but not everything integrated. And you can't save all the files in the same place or different snippets of every interview in the same place. It's a bit of a mess, too.
Have you used a tool called Notion before?
I have Notion. I have used Notion. I have used the what's it called now? It wanted for a video, especially for UX researchers. But you can edit the videos. You can have like all the. You can have create libraries. You can tag everything by subject, and they have like a whiteboard. You can pull this together in a whiteboard. I can send you the link after. Maybe you can put that in the description.
It's almost like we need a Gen AI tool that combines Miro, Notion, Google, and it can be a tag manager, sentiment analysis, video editor, all in one. Well, if anybody is listening who's in that space, there is an incredible tool to build for the researchers. Well, I think, Naira, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I think that brings us to a close. Maybe you could just tell the audience how they can stay in touch with you and your work.
Definitely. They were super fun to talk to you and to go through this lovely conversations that makes my brain sparkles. I definitely think that we will keep in touch and keep sharing those insights together. People can find me at scandinsights.com or Naira Moya Ericsson on LinkedIn. I'm happy to talk to everyone.
Fantastic. Well, we'll make sure that all of that information's in the show notes. We'll also, after the show, we'll get together all the information we've spoken about and put a few links in there to some of the tools and ideas and projects you're connected with. So, that does wrap up the show. So, whether you're a creator, a builder, or a player in the digital space, have fun and enjoy being at the frontier of technology that is definitely changing the future. We'll see you next time on Love, Hate, Automate.